the woman, giving him a big smile and extending her hand. "It's very nice to meet you," said Peepgas, taking her hand. He started to call her Mariah, but thought better of it. Mariah Bunting turned back toward Martha and said,
"Have you heard the dreadful news about Elizabeth Armholster?"
Halfway through the question, she flicked her eyes toward Peepgas for a split second before returning to Martha's face for a reply.
"I certainly have," said Martha. "I was at Paolo's, and some woman got a call about it on her cell phone. I was bowled over. Poor Ellen. That was all I could think about."
Paolo's was a Buckhead hair salon.
"You mean poor Elizabeth," said Mariah Bunting.
Martha said,
"I know."
But by now Mariah's eyes had settled on Peepgas.
"I didn't know a thing about it until Martha mentioned it on the way over," said Peepgas. "What are they saying on the news?"
"All I've heard—well, Ed and I, my husband Ed, we listened to the radio on the way over, and they didn't use the name. All they said was that this website on the Internet—what is it called?"
"Chasing the Dragon," said Peepgas.
"I think that's it. I remember the dragon part. Anyway, they'd broken the rules and used the name, and the girl's father's one of the most prominent businessmen in Atlanta. They were nice and pious about not using the name themselves."
She gave in to a smile beneath her ecstatic eyes, but quickly turned down the corners of her mouth. All three of them gave the lobby a quick survey. Martha saw a black couple over there near the wall. But they were light-skinned, and the man made you wonder if he was from England, the way he dressed.
"Well, I think it's just awful," said Martha. "I don't care whether it's the Internet or what. I think they ought to be ashamed." "Well, at least it looks like the newspapers and the television stations won't use it," said Mariah Bunting.
"They don't have to," said Martha, a weary little gesture.
"Just look around this place. That's all anybody's talking about, me included. Everybody whose opinion Ellen and Inman care about already knows. I couldn't believe it. Somebody actually called somebody else at Paolo's on a cell phone, for no other reason than to spread the word."
Peepgas and Mariah Bunting shook their heads. Peepgas, in his heart of hearts, couldn't have cared less one way or the other. But Mariah Bunting's eyes shone more ecstatically than ever. By the time the lobby lights had dimmed and brightened, dimmed and brightened, dimmed and brightened, to show the crowd it was time to get to their seats, three other grand dames, Letty Withers, Lenore Knox, and Betty Morrissey, had made their way over to Martha to say hello and cluck and fume over the dreadful news concerning Elizabeth Armholster. As for Martha, it was her considered and satisfied opinion that her becoming socially visible again had nothing to do with the Armholster affair, and everything to do with the fact that this thatchy-haired, youngish, and presentable man, Mr. Ray Peepgas, was once again by her side. Now they could see her again. As for Peepgas, what rang a bell with him was the fact that he knew all these names, the names of the rich and influential, Bunting, Withers, Knox, Morrissey, only from afar. A far, far, far distance from the world of Mr. Ray Peepgas of Unit XXXA Normandy Lee. In Martha Croker's company, he was a mere snap of the fingers away from a first-name familiarity with that world. If Lamprey knew that, he'd change his insulting tune. Macro decision. Yeah.
Deep into Beethoven's Sixth they were, this huge arc of human beings up on the stage, all laboring so earnestly with their cellos and oboes and English horns and flutes and whatnot. One moment they'd be working away down deep in a cellar, and then suddenly a shower of notes would rise up and come drizzling down on the audience. The deep sounds resonated in Peepgas's belly, and then the drizzle began again, and his mind wandered. It gave him a mildly headachy feeling. It reminded him of church.
His mother had trundled him off to Sunday school and the worship service at the Lutheran church right up to the time he was 10, and they moved from St. Paul, Minnesota, to San Jose, California. Somehow, religion never survived the trip, or maybe there was no Lutheran church to be had out there. Whatever it was, he remembered the heavy, headachy feeling that used to come over him. His mind used to wander just the way it was wandering now. They would be teaching them the catechism in Sunday school, and he'd be thinking about the time he was 4 years old, and he was going to demonstrate to a boy and a girl from the neighborhood that you could walk on ice. And he took 3 steps out on a pond and fell straight through into freezing water. And if his friends hadn't been there, he would have drowned or frozen to death. Oh, he was the smart one then, the smartest in every class he ever took, even if he hadn't known about the relative thicknesses of ice at age 4. He was the brightest, the most promising, every step of the way. And so why was he in the spot he found himself in tonight? Wildly into debt, and into the most childish form of debt at that, credit card debt, strapped for cash, unable to go to the symphony or a high museum opening, unless some female benefactor treated him to a ticket, barely able to assemble a pressed suit, a laundered shirt, and a decent necktie at one and the same time, going nowhere in his career, scorned by that top layer of humanity who make the macro decisions, thwarted, for now, in the most ambitious scheme of his entire life by a macro decision-maker whose neck was thrust forward like a dog's. Why was it so many business leaders were tall men like Lamprey, who was 6'4" or 6'5", even with his scoliotic dog's posture? Was that one of the host of things the aptitude tests didn't measure that had done Raymond Peepgas in? How could he climb up out of this hole and save himself? Here in the darkness, it wasn't so bad. The cellos, the oboes, the bassoons, and a viola were sawing and moaning and bassooning away in his midsection. Then a huge precipitation by the flutes, the trumpets, the clarinets, the violins, and the piano, which came raining down like a sudden afternoon shower in the Bahamas, but all under the cozy cover of darkness. In the darkness, the woman beside him was not a thick-set 53-year-old. She was a nice woman with tickets to all sorts of things. Martha's mind wandered onto the stage. Who on earth were these people up there, playing their instruments with such dedication? That one, the third violinist from the end, must be very close to her own age. A little bit heavy, pleasant-looking, didn't know what to do with her hair. What was her story? A sad story, she decided. Had seemed like such a virtuoso when she was a girl, a slender, confident, vivacious girl, who seemed to have all the talent in the world, the sort of free spirit who has an unerring instinct for falling for the wrong man. And now she's in her 50s, and one of a row of men and women playing the violin in Atlanta, Georgia. But at least she has her talent. She can fill up even the loneliest house with music. Or maybe she, Martha, had it all wrong. She'd love for them to put the music on hold, just a low, slightly melancholy symphonic background, and have the musicians rise up, one by one, and tell their stories. The dazzling promise of youth, the sag of middle age, and at the end. At the end of the row of violinists was a crumpled old man with wisps of hair and gray flesh that seemed to have melted over the end of the violin where he had tucked it under his chin. He lived alone, she decided. He and his wife had lived solely for one another, but she had died. Every stroke of the bow became a cry of sorrow. He eked out a living giving violin lessons, but to what end was all this would-be music? Meanwhile, his bow sobbed and sobbed. The thought brought a mist to Martha's eyes. 2 or 3,000 people in this one hall. And so much loneliness. And who besides herself paused long enough to pity the lonely? No one that she knew of. They all saw loneliness as a stigma, as a sign of failure, as a gaffe. It was a violation of etiquette, loneliness was, a source of embarrassment. That was what she had become as soon as Charlie walked out on her. An embarrassment. Mariah Bunting, Letty Withers, Lenore Knox, Betty Morrissey. Not one of them had the faintest notion who Ray Peepgas was. Nevertheless, he had rendered her visible again. The violin section was now still. The middle-aged violinist over here and the old man over there had lifted their cheeks and chins from their instruments. Their eyes were downcast, following the progress of the scores. Or were their minds drifting? What would be left for them after the music stopped? What would they have to go home to? It was no picnic for Beethoven himself, from what little she could remember. The drizzle was continuing steadily. In fact, it had become a regular downpour. When Beethoven really got himself worked up, there was no end to it. Peepgas tried to imagine himself as a composer, sitting at a desk in front of those lines, those staffs, and trying to think up notes. It was beyond him. Most of them had a bad time of it, even the great ones, as nearly as he could recall. But at least they left something, something their children could point to. If he got run over by a Lincoln Navigator tomorrow, what could they write about him? What they, as far as that went. They would have to be some loved ones who sent in a paid obituary to the Journal Constitution. And just who was going to do that? Betty? Syria? Master P.P. Peepgas? The boys? For one reason or another, he had hardly seen the boys since his separation from Betty. Wonder if they ever use the basketball backboard out in the driveway anymore. 46 years old, and he hadn't left so much as a footprint. Whereas somebody like Edward I. Bunting gives $5 million he doesn't need to the hospital, and they name a whole pavilion for him, and he's the great philanthropist, and nobody remembers that he made his money as an agricultural insecticide broker. They liked to talk about family here in the South, but money was what it all came down to at the end of the day. You could talk about family until you were hoarse, but if you were living in a starter rental in Collier Hills instead of a mansion in the West Paces Ferry section of Buckhead, who cared about your family? What good was a great chain of being that led straight down a 30-degree slope to a gully at the base of the cliff that supported I-75?
Well,
She worked out, didn't she? She was always talking about Definition America and a class taught by some Turk named Mustafa something or other. So maybe she—what was it Mickey Mantle said? The first thing he looked for in a woman was good calves. If the calves were in good shape, then chances were the thighs were in good shape. And if the thighs were in good shape, how bad could the abdominals and the rest of her be? And Martha had good calves. But she's still 53 years old, for Christ's sake. Relax, Peepgas. Think of it as a kind of arranged union. She's not stupid. At her age, it's not about children. She'll give you some room, and you'll give her some room, assuming she has anything to do in that big space you'll give her. But what would people say? A woman 7 years older than himself. Well, what do they say now? Harry Zale mocks him to his face for getting excited about the Croker case. And when he asks Arthur if he minds him asking a question, Arthur snaps, "I mind." As if he, Peepgas, has no business poking his nose into matters that are settled only on the 49th floor. As a matter of fact, He'd like to see the looks on their ugly mugs. Right now they treat him like a worker bee, don't they? Well, all that's going to change, one way or the other. The bows of the violins were swooping up and down like cricket legs. Why that image suddenly popped into her mind, she hadn't the foggiest idea. She looked to see if the old man could keep up with the lead violinist. Seemed to be holding his own. Ray was younger than she was. She didn't know by how much, but there was something about his looks that was still a little babyish. There was something a little too soft and passive about him. He was the kind of man any formidable woman, formidable from ambition or just plain meanness, would run right over. His wife had chucked him out of the house, just told him to scat, and he scatted. Not that Martha considered herself formidable. It had been hard to be formidable when you had been in the company of Charlie Croker for 29 years. But a woman might have to be formidable where Ray was concerned. He was bright, quick, but not at all tough. He would require a lot of maintenance. But he was good company, relaxing company, considerate company. Charlie could be embarrassing, especially when he was off on one of his tears. Ray would never be embarrassing. Not that this was a decision she would even have to make. This was the fifth time they had gone out, and Ray had never been anything other than what he was right now. There. She could make out only the vaguest of contours with her peripheral vision here in the darkness. It was entirely possible that he was interested only in getting a gold star at Planner's Bank for creating his beloved syndicate. Beethoven was going all out now, bassooning and celloing and drumming away in his belly, and sending up a heavy drizzle of notes at the same time. Made him slightly woozy, foggy, and, come to think of it, affectionate. Where would it lead? Hadn't the vaguest notion. What would it cost? Not much. After all, how angry could she get? Not very. It would be a compliment. He was a young man. In fact, as far as he could see, his appearance hadn't changed in 20 years. A couple of extra pounds. Still had his jawline. Something happened to men when they got up into their 50s and 60s. Their jawlines collapsed, melted, so that their cheeks began to puddle into their necks. No, the worst that could happen would be that she would feel complimented. The best that could happen? That he didn't have any clear picture of, since he had no real picture of where he wanted this to go. He'd have to wing it. Boom, 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 drizzle, 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 went Beethoven, and yet more drizzle, drizzle, drizzle. He felt warm and narcoleptic. He surveyed her out of the corner of his eye. The light from the stage created soft, indistinct highlights, which made her look roundish, as if she were made of ice cream. But that was just the play of light and shadow, the distortions of chiaroscuro. The woman had good calves. Good calves. Good calves. Her hands were in her lap, which presented a problem. If he tried to reach over her hand and engage it that way and reached too far, it might seem as if he was going after her crotch, which would turn the whole thing into abject farce. He turned his head ever so slightly and swiveled both eyes toward her. A gloss of light went down her forearm and stood at attention when it hit the gold of her wristwatch and her bracelets. Christ, she probably had more money on her one wrist than he could get his hands on in the form of discretionary income in 2 years. Anyway, the glistening gave him something visible to aim for. So? Should I? Why not? Here goes. He kept looking only long enough to make sure his hand would be heading directly toward her wrist. He didn't want to be looking at her when his hand touched hers. Why? It wasn't a question he had an answer for, beyond the fact that he had no idea in the world what he would have wanted such a look to say. His fingertips perceived all the highly wrought metal on her wrist, and in the next moment they found the palm of her hand and slid up the fingers. She had her chance, and that hand was not flying away, nor was she turning toward him with a jerk of incredulity. Her hand yielded as he interlaced his fingers with hers.
"Oh-ho! Well, there he is. What exactly is he up to?"
Her mind spun, not with emotion, but with sheerly logical computations. "I'm not 16 any longer. If I accept this bit of hand-holding, I'm implying a whole lot more, even though of what I can't be sure. But if I withdraw my hand, even with a light-hearted jest, then I'm saying no to whatever Ray can do for me by being at my side. If the lights suddenly came on, and all the world could see me holding hands with Mr. Raymond Peepgas of Planner's Bank, I'd be mortified. Why? That I can't quite figure out." By now his hand seemed terribly big and warm. Should she give it a slight squeeze? She decided no, for the simple reason that she had no idea what that squeeze would mean. Should she look at him? In what way? Warmly? Gratefully? Tenderly? Or with an ironic arching of the eyebrows, as if to say, "All in fun, okay, Ray?" The truth was, she had no idea what she even wanted to convey. She cut her eyes as far in his direction as she could without turning her head. With peripheral vision, she could see that he wasn't looking at her either. There they sat, holding hands in the darkness of Symphony Hall at the Woodruff Center. All the lonely violinists were pumping away like grasshoppers. At the end of the concert, as he and Henrietta were caught up in the tide of humanity in the lobby, Roger Two-White put a big, confident smile on his face and said to her, "I have to laugh. You know why they tacked Scott Joplin on at the end?" Talking about serious music, even to Henrietta, always made the dread nickname, Roger Two-White, pop into his head. "Why?" asked Henrietta. "It was a nice little piece of chocolate." He broke it off. He didn't want Henrietta to attach a double meaning to chocolate. Dessert. Sweets. Candy. A little reward to all these folks. He swung his head about to indicate the crowd about them. For sitting through the Stravinsky. He beamed at her, as if this was a terrifically amusing observation, and he was enjoying himself hugely. Being the only black folks in the place, so far as he could tell, he didn't want any of these folks, these white folks, thinking that he and Henrietta felt in any way ill at ease, out of place, subdued, intimidated. Henrietta said, "A nice little piece of chocolate, huh?" "I didn't mean it that way," said Roger Two-White. Once again he beamed grandly. "I don't think they tacked him on because he's African-American." Henrietta had become so with it, he had begun to be careful with his terminology around her. "I think it's because the maple leaf rag is familiar and happy, bouncy, good-humored. That was their reward for enduring Rite of Spring. You'd have seen some long faces if all these people got at the end was a big dose of Stravinsky." He put another 100 watts into his smile. "Oh, I don't know. In Atlanta, Stravinsky's still terribly modern. Cutting edge." "Oh, I don't know about in Atlanta. It's as if this was the opening performance of Le Sacre du Printemps. The only difference is that they're not courageous enough to boo. I don't know what they'd do if it was Schoenberg. Cut a wrist or make somebody resign, maybe." "I'm not sure they'd do anything different from what they're doing right now," said Henrietta. Then she drew closer to him so as not to have to raise her voice. "They're not even thinking about the music. All they're thinking about is Farik and the arm holster girl.
How do you know?
Because I listen.
That's all they were talking about when we got here, and that's all they're talking about now.
Roger looked about.
I'll be damned.
There was no doubt about it. After all, his picture had been in the paper 3 times, and he'd been on every television channel you could think of after the press conference. These people recognized him. He stood as tall as he could. Over there, 30 or 40 feet away, a white woman with puffed-up blonde hair was staring right at him. Then she smiled. He didn't know whether to smile back or what. Without turning her face away, the woman tugged on the arm of a tall white man next to her and said something to him, and he looked at Roger. Roger looked away, because it was getting embarrassing to be looking at these people without knowing how to respond, or even if he should. He sighed. He guessed he had the virus, publicity, but he wouldn't let it affect him. He had built up his career in an entirely different way. He wanted to mention it to Henrietta, the way these people were staring at him. He wanted to ask her, "Do you think some of these white people you see whispering, don't you think it's possibly because they recognize me?" But he wasn't fool enough to actually ask her. What a horse laugh she'd give him. As they moved ever so slowly in the tide of white people heading for the exits, he cut his eyes this way and that. And now he was sure people were looking at him. They recognized him. It was a feeling he had never known before. He couldn't hold back any longer. He began chuckling.
"What's funny?" said Henrietta.
He looked at her and suddenly felt even happier because of how pretty she was. He put his arm around her shoulder. He could feel the warmth of fate smiling upon him. Not a pretty wife. A gorgeous wife. Those big brown eyes of hers, set against her light tan skin, the soft lushness of her boue-en-train hairdo. And all at once he was famous, too. He leaned over and whispered into her ear, "Don't look now, but I'm afraid there are a lot of people in here who recognize the defender of Farik Fanon." Henrietta pulled back from him and gave him a look of the most sardonic bewilderment he had ever seen.
"Excuse me," she said. "They're doing what to the defender of Farik Fanon?"
Feebly. "Recognize."
"Are you serious?"
"Well, I only—"
"I don't doubt they're looking at you, Roger. But would you like to know the real reason, by any chance?"
"It's not a case of—"
"It's because you're an African-American."
He was bewildered.
"We're an oddity to them, a curiosity. African-Americans don't go to the symphony in Atlanta. These folks do everything but give away tickets at the MARTA stops to get African-Americans to come here, so they can feel better about themselves. And they still don't come. Just take a look around. They're looking at us as aliens, to give it the kindest word I can think of."
"I don't believe—" He didn't bother finishing the sentence. He was crestfallen. Henrietta must have realized some of that, because she now took his arm and snuggled up against him and said,
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean that the way it sounded. It's just that you're doing so well, and I don't want you to delude yourself. I'm very proud of you."
Roger didn't say anything. For the first time, he realized how much Henrietta detested these trips of theirs to the Woodruff Art Center. It made him feel like a blind fool, dragging her off to these white cultural events the way he had. But she was wrong about one thing. They did recognize him, damn it. Chapter 27 The Screen. Somehow Charlie had thought the operating room would be a white amphitheater, blazingly bright, with a large oval floor and a white wall 6 or 7 feet high around the oval, and above the wall, high-banked theater seats where doctors in white coats would sit to observe this important operation, or procedure, as M.O. Knuckles called it. Instead, it looked like one of those small leftover pieces of modern office space where office machines on casters are stored. It reminded him of the room at Planner's Bank where they had held the first workout session. And yet there was no feeling attached to the thought. It was as if all that terrible stuff was being held back by a dam or a levee. Whatever. Not that he could see a great deal. He was lying on his back on what seemed to be a narrow padded table, and there was a screen about a yard high that they had placed over his midsection, so that he couldn't see what they were doing to his knee. He had no feeling from the waist down. They had given him an epidural anesthetic. He had no idea what epidural meant, but that didn't matter. There seemed to be numerous tubes, some of which came out of him and some of which went into him. There was an oxygen mask over his nose and mouth. A high-pitched whine, like the whine of the rotary saws cutting into wood at the pulp mill where his daddy worked, and a high-frequency vibration ran up his upper spine. M.O., or he assumed it was M.O., was cutting off the tips of his right thigh bone and right shin bone, where they came together in the knee to get rid of the osteoarthritic crud, as M.O. seemed to enjoy calling it. But Charlie no longer cared whether M.O. called it that or not. Then they were supposed to fit pieces of titanic chromium cobalt. Or was it cobalt chromium titanium? It made no particular difference. Onto the ends of the bones to create a new knee joint, with a piece of polyethylene heavy molecular... whatever it was. Couldn't remember, which was all right. It was some piece of plastic something or other that replaced the cushion of cartilage between the two bones. They were sawing away down there, and he actually liked the vibration when it ran up his spine. He could hear them talking on the other side of the screen, and every now and then M.O. Knuckles would raise his voice, saying, "How's he doing?" A voice behind Charlie's head would say, "He's fine." Then M.O. himself came out from behind the screen. He had some sort of plastic framework on his head, and over the frame came a pale green tent with a picture window in it. His carpeted face was back behind the window. "It's going well, Charlie." M.O.'s voice was slightly muffled by the tent. "How are we feeling?" Charlie hated the patronizing medical "we," but now, who cared? M.O. looked like an astronaut. "M.O.," said Charlie, conscious that his voice was slowing down, "you look like an astronaut," said M.O. It wounded Charlie to learn in this manner that he had been about to say something that had obviously been said hundreds of times before. But a moment later, he wasn't really bothered by it. "Yeah," he said. M.O. turned around, and Charlie could see two big accordion-style rubber tubes running down his back. "We have our own air supply, just like the astronauts," he said. "Filtered air. Cuts down the risk of introducing any infectious agent into the incision." Then he turned back toward Charlie and said, "So, how are we feeling?" "I feel good," said Charlie. "I feel better than I did when I came in this morning." He looked up at the surgeonaut behind his tent window and halfway expected a gold star for being so strong and cheery under the stress of major surgery. "Now we're going to put in your new parts, your new joint," said the tent-muffled voice. "You'll notice the hammering, but don't worry about it. You won't feel any pain." Then M.O. disappeared on the other side of the screen. Charlie pondered upon the fact that he felt so good. He was flat on his back. He had tubes in the back of his hand, in the tip of a finger, in his spine,
in his urethra, a tube feeding him oxygen. He had no feeling in the lower half of his body, but he felt good. He would be perfectly happy to prolong this moment infinitely. Oh, yes, not just indefinitely, infinitely. The screen over his midsection was precisely what he wanted from this operation. He couldn't see the world, and the world couldn't see him. And time stood still. Oh, what a note of astonishment in M.O.'s voice when he had called him and said he wanted the operation. Now, soon as possible. Surgery would take him out of this world for weeks. There'd be nothing he could do. Nothing he was expected to do. No dilemmas he could solve. No dilemmas he would have to solve. No Inman. No Zale. This was a perfectly honorable and understandable withdrawal from the battle. Don't look at me. I have abandoned my fate to others. And if an infectious agent were introduced into the incision, if particles of bone marrow caused clots, what was the worst that could happen? God might be so kind as to take him away in the night. Then he could hear the hammering, and then he could feel it. It came in painless, dull thuds right up his spine and into the rear of his skull. The hammering was metal upon metal, but upon something bigger than a nail. They were driving the new metal ends of the femur and the tibia straight into the live bones. This operation was like a construction site. The "yeah" of the electric saws, the bing, 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 bing of the hammer, like a construction site. And he, Charlie Croker, knew about construction sites. His right knee was a construction site, and he had contracted himself out. But he couldn't complete the comparison. It made his head hurt. And besides, what difference did it make, all this mental activity? In the recovery room, Serena and Wally were looking down at him, in this horizontal life of his. He was lying on a narrow rolling bed with side rails. His right knee created a mound under the covers. He still couldn't feel a thing below the waist. Wally said, "You were awake the whole time, Dad?" "Yeah," said Charlie. "I couldn't feel anything, but I could hear saws, hammers, regular construction site." He smiled. He felt a compulsion to show that he had been a manly good sport. "Pretty interesting." "You know how long you were in there?" said Serena. "No, I guess I sort of lost track of time." "A little over 3 hours," said Serena. "Emma said it went very well." Serena was gently stroking the side of his right hand, the one with the IV tube inserted into a vein on the back of it. He still had a guilty feeling whenever Wally saw Serena showing him any physical affection. But he guessed this little bit didn't matter. Beneath her corona of black hair, her blue eyes had a tender look, such as he hadn't seen for a while.
"Did it make you nervous, Dad?"
Whether Wally was truly curious or just making conversation, Charlie couldn't tell. And in that moment he realized he had never come to know his son well enough to tell the difference, and never would. But that was all right. We just do the best we can. Whatever.
"No," said Charlie. "I actually felt good. A little tired. Had to get up so early. Couldn't have anything to eat or drink, far as that goes. But I felt good."
All at once he felt generous, magnanimous, appreciative, like a good boy.
"I'll tell you one thing. They got terrific nurses. You hear all these stories, but I got no complaints. This place, the nurses, they come in every 5 minutes, see if there's anything I want. By the time I went in, I was so relaxed, it was like I was taking, a walk in the park. By and by, M.O. Knuckles appeared. He still had on his pale green scrubs, but without the surgeonaut's head frame and tent. It occurred to Charlie that surgeons probably liked to walk around in the hospital with their scrubs, just to show the world that they were surgeons only recently departed from the medical front. But it was just a passing thought. It was all the same to him, one way or the other. M.O. peered down at him with a paternal smile, and then he said, "Well, Charlie, you're a bionic man now." Charlie said, "I could hear you sawing and hammering away in there. Sounded like a regular construction site." He was vaguely aware that he had just used this line with Serena and Wally. But who cared?
"Had to make sure all the parts were in there for keeps," said M.O. He still had his fatherly smile on. "I could feel it in my backbone," said Charlie. "The vibration came right up my backbone and into my head." "That's normal," said M.O. "Everything went according to plan. The only surprise was we found a little more necrotic tissue than we thought was there, but you're going to be fine. We'll have you out jumping rope." Charlie felt another urge to demonstrate that he was a good boy, a stout fellow, a model patient who was mindful of the contributions of others. "M.O.," he said in his slow voice, "I want you to do something for me."
"What's that, Charlie?"
"I want you to thank the nurses for me."
"The nurses?"
"Yeah. They were in to see me every 5 minutes before I went into surgery. They made me feel so relaxed. By the time I went in there, I thought I was going for a walk in the park. They were fabulous. I want you to tell them that for me."
M.O. smiled. Then he pursed his lips and cast his eyes downward to one side, and began to nod his head as if to agree with the profound sentiment his model patient had just expressed. Then he looked at Charlie and said, "I'll do that, Charlie. They are fabulous, and I'll tell him you said so. But Demerol's pretty fabulous, too." Wally started laughing. Charlie didn't know why at first. He looked up at Serena, who was trying to suppress a smile. Then M.O.'s wisecrack made its way through the Demerol dike in his brain. Wally was laughing, Serena was trying not to laugh, and M.O. was smiling the knowing smile of the fatherly wise man. There was no reason he, Charlie, had to take that kind of mockery from M.O. Knuckles. But, at the same time, whatever. North of the Marta tracks, Chambly still looked like the old country town it had always been. And it was in old Chambly that Conrad found himself walking on this warm, bright June morning. He felt groggy from lack of sleep and from tension. He wasn't sure he could spend another night at the Meadowlark Terrace, sweating, sweltering, along with a dozen, 2 dozen, God knew how many Vietnamese. Lying on the floor curled up with his overnight bag pressed into his midsection for safekeeping, listening to the incessant and incomprehensible click-clack of the conversations around him, waking up 4, 5, 6 times a night with a start. Soon enough, eating would become just as big a problem. He had only $272 left of the $1,500 Kenny had given him. If he continued to eat at restaurants on the Buford Highway, that would melt away all too quickly. Without intending to in the slightest, he thought about how he had commandeered the jeep at Camp Parks. Even in his thoughts, he avoided the word stolen, and experienced a wave of guilt. One might, Zeus might, forgive taking an army jeep in the middle of an earthquake, but no such commandeering, appropriating, or borrowing would be forgivable in a quiet little town like Chambly. In turn, the sense of guilt over something he had only briefly entertained the thought of doing made him wonder just what he must look like to the residents of this little town. A young man with short hair, swarthy skin, delicate features, clean-shaven. He had managed to get into the bathroom for that long this morning, wearing blue jeans, a polo shirt, a navy windbreaker, construction boots that still looked new, carrying an overnight bag. Nothing remarkable about his appearance, he concluded with satisfaction. Except for one thing. There was not another soul walking along these streets. All at once, as if it had been caused by his own premonition, he could hear a car slowing down behind him. Then he could hear its hushed idle as it coasted closer. Didn't dare look around. Now, in his peripheral vision, he could tell that it was right beside him. Which was the cooler thing to do, ignore it or turn toward it? Since the driver would know you were bound to have noticed the car by now. Beside. He turned his head. Sure enough, a police cruiser, with a gold badge and the legend Chambly Town Police painted on a white door. The policeman, thick-set, wearing aviator-style glasses, was smiling at him. Just that, smiling at him and letting the cruiser drift forward at the pace of Conrad's walk. Conrad was already ransacking his memory for the answer to the inevitable question. Why? At the same time, another decision. Which was cooler, to maintain eye contact and stop, maintain eye contact and keep walking, or break eye contact and keep walking? Decide. He nodded with a neutral and, he devoutly hoped, cool expression on his face, turned his head, and kept walking. The cruiser kept drifting along beside him. What now? Ignore him or not? Oh, Zeus, decide.
Where are you heading?
Conrad turned his head and then stopped. The man was still smiling. Conrad fought the urge to swallow and to blink. A scrap of memory caught it. I'm looking for a shop, an antique shop called Hello Again. The policeman, his big neck straining against his shirt collar, kept staring at him and smiling. Conrad fought to keep control of his eyes, his mouth, and his throat. It was precisely now that the man was deciding whether to check him out or let him go. Finally,
up there at the next street, you'd take a right, and it's two blocks from there, that way.
He pointed in that direction. Then he dropped the smile and said, "Have a nice day," and winked and pulled away in the cruiser. Winked, as if to say,
"I don't believe a word of it, but I'm going to let you be."
Conrad's heart was pounding. He figured he'd better head for real to Hello Again, a shop he'd had a single stray glimpse of the first day after he arrived. The shop was in an exhausted old wooden frame house on a corner. Part of the original clapboard facade had been cut away and framed to create a show window. The merchandise was above the level of a flea market, but not a great deal. The prize item was an old J.C. Higgins balloon tire bicycle, unfortunately a bit rusty. Inside, in a room that must not have been painted in a quarter century, were an old man and an old woman. Both were morbidly fat. The old man was sitting at a desk in the rear reading a pamphlet. As he checked out Conrad, he opened his mouth and stuck his big bulbous tongue into a stretch of gums where there was a row of teeth missing. His pants, an old pair of navy serge pants, now shiny at the knee and on his fat thighs, were zipped up as far as they would go, which was where his underbelly began bulging out in a thoroughly irreducible way. The old woman, who was standing in the front, wore a capacious shift, apparently homemade, with no sleeves, so that the pitted gobs, the garlands of fat that jiggled on the backs of her arms, were exposed. Her skin was a livid white, and her hair was random wisps of gray. but on her face were red splotches that spread or grew smaller according to how much she exerted herself. All around, on shelves, in freestanding glass cases on the floor, was stuff. Pieces of tarnished silverware, most of them knives and spoons, wrinkled Victorian Christmas cards, a partial set of teacups with handles in the shape of nymphs doing backbends, teetering stacks of old National Geographics, inkstands with the silver plate wearing off, a pair of women's rubber galoshes with scalloped edges, where one side closed and snapped over the other. A moth-eaten fox stole in which the fox seemed to be holding his tail in his mouth. In short, junk. Little as Conrad knew about antiques, the thought of trying to sift for the precious pieces possibly hidden among these heaps was too demoralizing to be attempted. The room had a sharp, slightly sour smell that reminded Conrad of something familiar, but he couldn't name it. A sooty, gray-green wallpaper was torn away at the corners, revealing a veritable archaeological dig of various wallpapers underneath. The old woman sized up Conrad, then cocked her head in a slightly challenging way, and said, "Hip you, young man?" Then she resumed chewing her cud.
"I was wondering about the bicycle in the window," said Conrad.
"That old J.C. Higgins," she said. "Pretty thing."
"I was wondering how much it is," said Conrad.
$100, she said. "Got good tires, too. You can ride it right out of here."
There was a lump in her cheek that she kept moving around with her tongue. Then she took a McDonald's paper cup out from behind a lamp with four glass ionic columns as a base, held it up to her face so that it covered her mouth, and spat into it. Chewing tobacco. Conrad shook his head. "Can't afford that much. I need a way to get around, but..." Rather than try to finish the sentence, he shook his head some more. She said,
"How much can you afford, son?"
The old man made a hawking sound in his throat. Conrad looked about. The old man also had a McDonald's cup over his mouth. Then he put that one down behind a framed sepia-tone picture of a baseball player named Cecil Travis, and picked up another one and tilted it back to his lips. The sweet smell of brown whiskey, bourbon, or rye spread through the room. It was part of an even ranker odor, which was the odor of poverty. As his eyes got used to the gloom of the place, he noticed a pot-bellied stove obscured by the great bulk of the old man. An old-fashioned stovepipe rose from the stove and curved into the wall. That, no doubt, accounted for the sharp, sour smell. Coal fumes.
"I don't exactly know," said Conrad, answering the old woman. Somehow, he couldn't have accounted for why, he trusted her. "I need a way to get around, but I also need a place to stay."
The old woman glanced at the old man and then said,
"What kind of place you want?"
"A room somewhere, I guess," said Conrad.
"I can't afford much."
"Where you staying now?"
she asked.
"With some friends over near the highway," said Conrad. "But they don't have enough room."
"Over in Shambodia?" said the old man with a chortle.
"I don't know," said Conrad, not wanting to get onto that topic. "I think they said it was Chambly."
"Huh," said the old man. "That's what we used to call it." "We've lived in this house for four generations," said the woman. "Us Mungers I'm talking about. Our granddaddy, brother and mine," she nodded in the direction of the old man, "fought in the Civil War. He wasn't a drummer boy, either. He was in the infantry, started out as a private. Fought at Chickamauga, Atlanta, Jonesboro. Finally got wounded at Jonesboro. He was a major by then. Battlefield promotions. Our mother went to Agnes Scott College for 2 years.
Conrad could think of no adequate response to these revelations.
"Ah,"
he said, nodding his head as if in pleasant surprise.
"I'll be switched if I know how this town suddenly went Oriental," said the woman.
"You know darn well, sister," said Brother. "It's that chicken plant in Knowlton. Won't no white man work there, and no black man either, these days. So they wants the Orientals, but they don't want 'em living in Knowlton, so they park 'em in Chambly and Doraville."
"Well, to tell the truth, that's another thing," said Conrad. "I need a job, too. What about the chicken plant?"
"No, no, no," said Brother, who always massaged the toothless part of his gums with his tongue before he spoke. "The smell'll finish you off all by itself."
"What smell?"
"The smell of thousands of chickens, and we're talking about thousands. The smell of thousands of chickens with their intestines hanging out."
"You go to church?" said Sister.
Conrad hesitated. He knew from the very question itself that the proper answer was yes, so he took a chance.
"I go to the Church of Zeus."
"Church of Zeus?" said Sister. "That's a new one on me." "You sure it ain't the Church of the Zion Crossroads?" said Brother.
"No, it's Zeus," said Conrad. "Started up about the time of Nero."
"Where you gonna find one around here?" said Sister.
"That's the problem," said Conrad. "Not many of 'em anywhere."
"Sister and me's Methodists," said Brother. "Our mama and papa were UBs, but we're Methodists."
"UBs?" asked Conrad.
"United Brethren," said Brother. "But Sister and me's Methodists. The only thing I don't like about the Methodist Church is the hymns. John Wesley wrote half of 'em, and he never had the knack for it, if you ask me. The Episcopalians got the hymns. I'll give 'em that much."
He burst into song.
"Lord God of hosts, be with us yet, lest we forget, lest we forget, forget."
He had a surprisingly good tenor voice, which ranged over two octaves in those few lines.
"What kind of hymns your Church of Zeus got?"
"Not much," said Conrad.
"Well, it's like I say, when it comes to your hymns, the Episcopalians are the beatenest."
He burst into song once more.
"A mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing, our helper he amid the flood, o'er mortal ills prevailing."
Then he said, "That's another thing. If you're in the Episcopal Church, they call you Episcopalians. If you're in the Methodist Church, they call you Methodist. What do they call you if you're in the Church of Zeus? A Zeusian?"
"No, a Stoic," said Conrad.
"A Stoic?" "Yeah, people tend to think of Stoics as people who are long-suffering and don't complain. But it's a whole religion."
"Don't sound Christian," said the Brother.
"It's pre-Christian," said Conrad. "The Stoics influenced the early Christians."
"Uh-huh."
Brother gave Conrad a searching gaze.
"What kind of work you done before?"
"Trucker's helper, warehouse man, construction. But I don't have a trade. I'll do anything, though."
"Truck loadin'. You don't look the type," said Brother. "Let me see your hands."
Conrad spread his fingers wide and offered his hands for inspection, palm first.
"I take it back," said Brother. "Sister, look at—" "What's your name, anyway?"
"Connie," said Conrad. "Connie de Cassi."
"Well, thank the Lord for that," said Sister. "A young man who volunteers his last name. All these kids today, they only have first names. Makes you think they're drug dealers. Well, getting back to what we were saying. By the way, where are your folks?"
Conrad hesitated. "They're both dead."
"Where was you brought up?"
said Sister.
"All over the place. Macon, most recently."
"Where'd you live in Macon?"
Luckily, he remembered the address on his fake driver's license. 2700 block of Cypress.
Don't know it, said Brother. Getting back to what we were saying, said Sister, you say you need a room, eh?
I sure do, said Conrad. Sister looked toward Brother and must have gotten a sign of approval, because she said,
Well, we have a room here we rent out sometimes. It's up on the third floor.
How much is it? Asked Conrad.
$75, said Sister.
A week?
No, a month. We like the rent in advance.
Sister led Conrad up a gloomy staircase, which had stacks of Atlantic monthlies from God knew back when on every step, next to the wall. On the second floor, Conrad got a glimpse of two dismal bedrooms heaped so full of books, magazines, and bric-a-brac. The only part you could see of their floors, which were linoleum, was the pathways they had cleared from the doorways to the beds. In a corner of the hallway was a small bathroom with an old soapstone basin. By the time Sister headed up the stairway to the third floor, she was breathing loudly. She had a way of moving from step to step by sidling her bulk this way and that.
"Stairs in this house. Gonna finish me off, reckly."
The third floor was underneath the eaves. There were several small rooms with dormer windows, but they were so chock-a-block with stuff, they looked impenetrable. Such light as there was in the tiny hallway came from a bulb screwed into the ceiling with a disintegrating parchment shade clipped to it upside down. Sister led Conrad to a doorway. A narrow dormer window, bereft of curtain or shade, admitted a shaft of light into the room within. In this one, the floor was not absolutely choked with Sister and Brother Munger's Hello Again collection, merely heavily littered. In a corner beneath an eave was a narrow bed, the narrowest bed Conrad had ever seen, much narrower than an ordinary twin size, with an old painted metal bedstead and some sort of ornately handworked but dusty and yellowish-white counterpane. Half the counterpane was covered with ceramic lamp bases lying on their sides.
"Things sort of need putting away in here," said Sister, panting hard from the climb. "But that's a good old bed, and nobody's made a Madelasse counterpane like that one right there in 100 years. Getting hot out already."
She swept a perilously hanging droplet of sweat from the tip of her nose with the back of one hand and the sweat of her brow with the back of the other one. The little room was stifling, and the eaves were pressing down from both sides. But something told Conrad this was about as good as an exhausted, unemployed, escaped convict was going to be able to get on short notice for $75 a month. And besides, although this yearning he couldn't have put into words, here he would have fellow humans to talk to, even if it was only this pair of old pack rats. Eccentric they were, garrulous they were, inert they were. Tobacco chewers they were, and McDonald's cup spitters, but they seemed to have good hearts. He had already lived in a place where everyone was young and bursting with energy to burn, and every heart was malevolent. It was called Santa Rita. After completing his cash transaction with Sister, Conrad set about the task of putting away. Even though it consisted of nothing more than arranging all the sad old rubbish in orderly ranks beneath the eave opposite the bed, it took him more than 3 hours. Then he took off his boots and lay down on the dusty, yellowing old Madelasse counterpane, and closed his eyes, and listened to his heartbeat, and sweated, and congratulated himself. A bed of his own. For the next 30 days. Oh, Zeus! A bed of his own, and the grand sum of $197 left in his jeans. Day 2. No more Demerol. No more immersion in the mindless sea of narcosis, in the hemisphere of whatever. Charlie was an enormous aching knee with attachments. His upper and lower right leg, his torso, his other leg, his arms, neck, his tormented head, and his bladder, which required him to undergo the indignity of a bedpan. As armor against such insults to his status, all of which proceeded from the hospital patient's role as a frightened organism upon which superior beings practiced their medical arts, Charlie insisted on wearing a brilliant blue tie silk robe with white paisley designs upon it, as if it were a royal blue that would strike the hearts of one and all with fear of the king. In fact, regiphobia, if any, didn't seem to deter his keepers for a second. M.O. Knuckles kept coming by and treating Charlie, who was 20 years his senior, as if he, M.O., were a parent who, while patient and forbearing, would be obeyed. Specifically, he ordered him to obey his physical therapist, a hawk-faced woman who refused to be charmed or amused. She compelled him to do all sorts of painful things with his knee, even to the point of making him get out of bed and support his weight with his throbbing knee with only an aluminum walker to help him support his weight. The walker clanked and rattled in its aluminum joints with every tiny step he took. By the time he got back in bed, he would be panting like a dog. He felt deceived. M.O. had always described the operation as if it were a piece of carpentry. All the bones and cartilage in the model on M.O.'s desk had seemed so cleanly mechanical. "Saw off a bit of this nice white plastic part here. Insert a nice gleaming titanium tip there. Tuck a nice inert piece of plastic padding between here and there." In fact, the son of a bitch had cut through living tissue, taken a bloody saw to his thigh bone and his shin bone, which were full of living blood, cells, nerves, molecules, DNA. He wasn't sure about DNA. Nerves there were, for sure. The incision ran from way up here to way down there, and it looked as if it had a tight red tube running the length of it and held in place by strips of flesh-colored plastic tape that ran crossways. The red tube was actually the flesh and blood where the incision had been closed, and the skin all around it felt as if it were about to burst. Charlie tried to keep his mind focused on the knee, the suture, the pain. Surely the pain would be enough to keep his mind off everything else. There was a little machine called the CPM, for continual passive motion, which they had placed under his knee, and it flexed your knee for you, whether you wanted it to or not. Hurt like hell. Why endure so much pain when all you wanted was for God to take you away in the night? Somewhere out there, perhaps at this very moment, Farik Fanon's lawyer, a black man who dressed like a British diplomat, was making plans for a press conference, at which he, Charlie, wearing a shabby mask of racial harmony, would hold forth in the insolent canon's behalf, in an outright betrayal of Inman Armholster. And if he reneged on that deal, this guy Zell, or Zale and Planner's Bank, stood ready to strip him of every piece of real estate he had, starting with turpentine. Just then the goddamned CPM under his knee went into action, and his knee joint bent, and the pain shot through his entire nervous system until he grimaced and groaned. Ugh! But soon they were back. Inman, Zale, and lawyer Roger White, stamping around in his skull, demanding attention. Charlie had private nurses on the 4 p.m. to midnight shift, and from midnight to 8 a.m., but not from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. There was so much activity during the day, what with the doctors, nurses, orderlies, visitors, and a fellow who swept and mopped the floors coming by. He didn't need a private nurse. Not that he truly needed one on the other shifts. But they were like the brilliant blue robe. They showed that he was not just some poor gork stretched out on his back. He couldn't roll over on his side for fear of twisting his knee. If he wanted to shift his position, he could elevate his back by pushing a button that caused the head of the bed to lift.
or he could reach up and grab a couple of handles that hung down above his chest and pull hard and shift his weight a few inches this way or that. That soon became his way of greeting visitors, his version of standing up out of politeness. Not that he was anxious to have visitors. He didn't want any more reminders of the world outside than were absolutely necessary, although he wasn't so far gone that he would couch it in those terms. Serena, Wally, the Wiz, Marguerite, they were the only people to be admitted to his room. Early in the afternoon, the Wiz arrived. He looked as gaunt as ever, with his sunken cheeks and his neck that never quite filled up his shirt collar. But he had an un-Wiz-like smile spread out down below the titanium rectangles of his eyeglasses. Charlie tugged on the handles above the bed, moved himself a fraction of an inch, groaned in a subdued way, and said, "Hello, Wiz." It was a dispirited voice, for in his present state Charlie couldn't imagine anyone being pleased by anything. The Wiz pulled up an armchair with hospital plastic upholstery and sat down, the remnants of his smile still playing about the corners of his mouth. "Well, Charlie, how's it going?"
"Slowly," said Charlie. "They make it sound so simple beforehand."
The Wiz said,
"I've always heard it requires a high pain threshold."
"Yeah, or whatever," said Charlie. "That and the patience of a saint."
"Well, I've come to cheer you up, Charlie.
Or I guess you could say I have good news and bad news. Which would you like first?"
"Surprise me."
"Okay, I will.
For some reason, and I have not called them to ask why, Planners Bank has suspended its campaign of rationalized harassment. They've called off the dogs. We haven't heard a sound from them all week."
He beamed at Charlie.
Charlie knew he ought to register pleasant surprise, if only to indulge the Wiz's excitement. But he couldn't play-act. He felt submerged by a wave of guilt. They had called off the dogs because he had agreed to betray Inman Armholster.
"Good," he said in a glum way, but sent out the signal, "It's too late, or it's not enough."
The Wiz's smile receded. "The bad news—it's not specifically bad news for us. I suppose it falls under the heading of sad news. You know the case of Farik Fannin and the rape charge and so forth?" Charlie nodded. "Well, you'll never guess who the girl involved is." The Wiz's barcode scanner eyes were lit up with 1,000 watts.
"Tell me," said Charlie tonelessly.
"Elizabeth Armholster.
Inman Armholster's daughter." 2,000 watts. Charlie shook his head and compressed his lips. The Wiz no doubt interpreted it as a look of sympathy and regret.
"How'd you learn that?" said Charlie.
"Some internet website carried her name," said the Wiz. "It's an odd situation because nobody else is using her name. You don't see it in the Journal Constitution, you don't hear it on television, and yet the name's all over town, and it's all over the internet. I've heard of plenty of situations where they don't publish a rape victim's name, but I've never heard of one in which the victim was the daughter of such a well-known man." Charlie looked away and shook his head some more, wave after wave of guilt.
"You're really not feeling so hot, are you?" said the Wiz.
"That's true," said Charlie.
In fact, he felt profoundly depressed. He reached for the handles above his chest and pulled himself up a few inches. He wanted the Wiz to see that he still had strength. He wanted him to see more of his brilliant blue robe. But for what earthly reason? He couldn't think of one.
"I wouldn't attach too much significance to the Planners Bank thing. It's hard to say what it means. It may not mean anything."
He couldn't believe he was actually going to betray Inman in order to get a bank off his back. Just then the telephone on his bedside table rang. Immediately up and on his feet, the Wiz said, "You want me to get it?"
"Would you?" Wearily.
and find out who it is. The Wiz answered the telephone, listened a few moments, then put his hand over the receiver's mouthpiece and said to Charlie,
"It's Marguerite."
Charlie sighed and nodded and closed his eyes and lifted his hand, as if to say, "I'm tired, and this is an imposition, but I'll take it." Marguerite's voice said,
"I'm really sorry to bother you, Charlie, but how you feeling?"
"So-so, not great."
"Listen, I'm really sorry, but that lawyer from Ringer Fleesum called, that, you know, Roger White, and he kept saying it was urgent that he speak to you. Something about an appointment you had, or have, with him next week."
Charlie could feel his heart speeding up, taking off. "What'd you tell him?"
"What I've been telling everybody. You're away and can't be reached, but you'll be checking in from time to time. Then he wanted to know away where. He'd be happy to call you wherever. He was really insistent."
"What'd you say to that?"
"I told him you hadn't made your itinerary available."
"And he said?"
"He said to remind you that this appointment was extremely important. What do you want me to do, if anything?"
"Nothing," said Charlie. "You did the right thing. No need to tell anybody any more than that." He said goodbye, sighed again, closed his eyes, and held the receiver up in the air, thereby implicitly instructing the Wiz to put it back upon the telephone's cradle, which he did. Charlie kept his eyes.